Welcome back. Another episode. I think we're at 319. Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well. Well, so far. Although from what I understand, we might be edging towards nuclear war. Not over Russia or Ukraine, but over Israel. This week we had Ben Shapiro, or was it last week? Maybe it was the tail end of last week. Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin, both Jewish American commentators, political commentators, supposedly conservative, threatened nuclear war over the Gaza crisis. This is perhaps they're alluding to the so-called Samson option. And of course, I didn't, it wasn't quite official, but from what I understand is Israel's not supposed to have a nuclear arsenal, but it does. And for
Yeah.
the longest time, it was a bet. Worst kept secret. They acquired this through all types of trickery and espionage. We can talk a little bit about that. It's quite a story in and of itself. But apparently, according to Ben Shapiro and some Israeli lawmakers and officials, that in the use of nuclear weapons is not off the table to respond to Hamas. Now, I would say that's a bit disproportionate, nor is it practical given the terrain. I don't know, are they going to nuke the Gaza Strip or the West Bank or Lebanon? That's from what I understand, it's their neighborhood anyway. And for when I'm told about the destructive power of nuclear weapons, even tactical nuclear weapons, that really isn't practical. But it was interesting because I think it was Ben Shapiro, who holds no, I mean, political power, of course, other than the fact that he's Jewish and he apparently identifies much more with Israel than he does with the United States. Because over this crisis, a turf battle in the Middle East in Levant, he's willing to consider the use of nuclear weapons. He called it a nuclear exchange. Now, I don't know which adversaries Ben Shapiro is talking about, because from what I understand, Hamas does not have a nuclear arsenal, nor does Hezbollah and Iran, from what I understand, doesn't either, despite the claims of the Our Israeli government. It's kind of funny because I've been taught to believe that it's the Iranian nuclear program that we're supposed to be concerned with, yet it is the Jews that are saber rattling with nuclear weapons now over this crisis, which they've largely created, of course. Nevertheless, I know Mark Levin said a similar thing in an interview, saying that what if you don't expect these nuclear weapons to collect dust forever. What does that mean? Well, I hope they collect dust forever. If they're as destructive as people claim they are, that's the whole idea, is that they collect dust. That's what deterrence is all about, from what I understand. That's what a mutually assured destruction and deterrent system is all about. And the Israelis themselves claimed, to the extent they admit that they have an arsenal, that they only developed this nuclear weapons defensively to prevent yet another Holocaust, as they always claim. But we have this threat going out there that apparently it was. In this interview, I think it was Levine who said, if we don't, and both Levine and Shapiro said, if the United States isn't generous with aid and support, that Israel will have no option, other option than eventually use these weapons. Again, against whom? I don't know. Again, are they alluding to the Samson option, which I think involves blowing up European cities, basically saying, if indeed Israel's existence is threatened by its adversaries in the region, that it will blow up the world, hence the Samson option, bring the, knock down the pillars or bring the ceiling down on everybody. That's the threat. So just to how crazy it is. Now, we were told that Israel is able to defend itself, but nevertheless, we're told if US doesn't support Israel defending itself, provide generous aid, even perhaps even ultimately military support, that they're going to threaten to drop the bomb, as they say. So that's just how crazy this has become. Now we can talk about the nuclear Iran's I'm sorry, Israel's nuclear program and that sordid history, because that dates as far back as the early 60s and the 50s, and also perhaps the Kennedy assassination. So what do you say about this nuclear brinkmanship on behalf of Israel?
Well, I think the Samson option is something that needs scrutiny. Far as I know, I mean, there was discussion as far back as like the 1990s about, an overwhelming nuclear response by Israel. It's never been like an official government policy. They don't talk about it. You don't get government statements from, the Knesset or some government official about we're going to blow up the world if we're attacked. But a lot of Jewish intellectuals in their publications mention it. I think it was Paramatur, the LSU professor. He wrote, that in an article that you needed to think about destroying the world. He wrote, "Bring down the pillars of the world, attack Moscow and European capitals, as well as all places of Islam." And that he said you need to have an abandonment of proportionality is the essence of the Samson option. And then more famously, in like 2012, Günter Grass had written a poem kind of which was called What Must Be Said, German, writer, and he just criticized Israel's nuclear weapons program. And then you had Itamar Yazet Ketsi, who was a Holocaust survivor. There's quite a few survivors.
Yes.
And he wrote the poem, The Right to Exist. And it was actually directed against or to Gross. And it contained the sentence, if you force us yet again to descend from the face of the earth to the depths of the earth, let the earth roll toward the nothingness. Now, the nothingness is a, it's kind of a critical word. It's biblical. They talk about dissolving. And if you look in Isaiah, you'll see that dissolving is related to Gentiles. And basically, it means, complete extermination. So this isn't ambivalent. I mean, he's actually, describing an end of the world as a response to Israel facing, being losing a military battle and losing its status as a nation. And so, then the Jerusalem Post said, they actually then used the term new Samson option in description to it. And they said, it's taking out of Israel's enemies and causing irreparable damage to the entire world. And that this, so what you've got really is a kind of doomsday device, just like in Dr. Strangelove, that they're talking about, like Samson pulling down the, the temple on top of himself or the building on top of himself and killing his enemy at the same time. So they're talking about an end of the world. So this is an extreme position of ethnocentrism, right? I mean, this is saying our ethnicity, if it doesn't survive, we want all the other ethnicities to perish.
No,
Okay.
they equate the existence of the Israeli state to the existence of the Jewish people. Now,
Exactly.
if I do my history, I think the Jewish people have existed long before the Israeli state, a lot
Well,
longer.
without it, right, of course. So it's very bizarre, but nevertheless, this is the position. And I would just say that what needs to, happen analytically is people need to go, well, let us look how ethnocentrism is analyzed in the authoritarian personality. Let's look at this, which is the indication that Europeans are neurotic. It's a kind of mental illness to have ethnocentric ideas. Maybe it's just clear cut that they actually have a scale. The more ethnocentric you are, the more crazy you are. It's just a horrible thing. And this position kind of seeps into all of our universities. Cultural Marxism, makes a long march. And we are now all basically victims of this concept. And yet here, they have the most extreme ethnocentric position is possible. And there is no criticism of them as racially insane. And so that is kind of, when you see read Shapiro and Levine, what you're seeing is just in back of their multicultural sort of position that they present to the world many times, there really is a kind of just emotionally passionate ethnocentrism that transcends everything.
Yeah, I
It is
thought they were American conservatives.
right. What happened to that? I mean,
Yes.
the idea that their position in defense of Israel would destroy the United States and the rest of the world, quite possibly, is not really even considered. So it's an exposing of the hypocrisy that, and also the complete incoherency of the ethnocentric scale authoritarian personality influence in our culture, because the Jewish position of ethnocentrism, which the Samson option comes out of, is never criticized and is always considered appropriate, or at least it's a reasonable idea.
Well, just the fact that Israel has an arsenal as many as 200 nuclear weapons of thermonuclear, intercontinental, nuclear submarines and tactical weapons and foreigners, and also a biological chemical warfare program, they're not subject to any inspection. They're not a signatory to nuclear non-proliferation treaty. Their rejection of inspections, this is what occurred in the 1960s. The last president to assert to contain attempt to contain Israel's nuclear program was John F. Kennedy, and he was assassinated soon thereafter. And the next president, Lyndon Johnson, backed off completely. No other president has ever pressured Israel in regards to their nuclear weapon program, which is illegal, and also the fact that it was acquired through an espionage operation within the United States. This was the NUMEC plant, where the enriched uranium was stolen. And of course, the NUMEC plant was owned by Jews. Nevertheless, it had a contract to enrich uranium by the U.S. So it was given the material, which then these Jews who owned it transferred it to Israel. Once again, we have an example of Jews being entrusted with secrets, national security secrets, and all types of, I guess, power within the United States, using it against the interest of the United States and helping Israel. So they, again, as much as Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin identify with Israel first, go back to the 1960s, these men who owned or operated the NUMEC plant, who were Jewish, again, immediately turned around and gave the material to Israel to develop their own weapon systems. They were never investigated for this or faced any legal consequences for this espionage, but nevertheless, it occurred. Again, and then we don't hear any pressure in the press or about, we hear a lot about North Korea and Iran and rogue states and even Iraq. Remember Iraq, new weapons of mass destruction. We actually invaded and occupied that country on behalf of Israel, but nothing is said about this nuclear program, which then Israel threatens to blow the Western world up if they don't get their way. And so again, it's just one of these things that yet another double standard we have to just accept because they're Jewish and because of the Holocaust. Shimon Peres, I think, is one that spearheaded the operation in the late 60s. He was interviewed in the 90s about it, and he gives this interview. I hear him talking. He says, "We have to do this because we're confronted with a bunch of gangster states like Iraq, and because of the Holocaust." Again, here we have projection because it was Iran, which is the internet, I'm sorry, Israel, which is the international menace, which is the gangster state actually founded by Jewish gangsters using gangster tactics, terrorism, these things. Everything is projection, the same way they project on the world. Just like we hear stories of like Hitler in the bunker saying that the German people no longer deserve to survive because they weren't up to the task, so Germany must be destroyed, and he gives the order to Albert Speer to destroy everything. This and also the fact he wouldn't surrender, so this final battle, this madness. But then we have the Israel with its Samson option is 10 times more deranged than that narrative. Again, we have projection here, all based on this strong ethnic identity, their right to exist, and not to exist. They equate existence with dominance. If they don't dominate, they don't exist. And that's how neurotic and how solipsistic and how crazy this is. If they have to give anywhere, and a good example, if they just were to withdraw to the 67 borders and make peace, you probably have peace in the area because practically speaking, people would accept those terms. But the problem with Zionism is it's expansionist, well beyond the borders, right? Of they don't have borders. Israel doesn't even declare its own border, so it's constantly expanding. And under the doctrine of Zionism, I alluded to this last week, is they don't think the Palestinians have a right to exist in that area. So there's no peaceful options. There's no good faith effort on part of the Israeli government, particularly as it becomes, we talk about it becomes more and more religious and fanatical as demographics change in Israel, to negotiate in good faith with the Palestinians or any other party for that matter. So we have this is what we have, and then they're able to exercise or leverage the power of the Jewish diaspora throughout the West, particularly the United States. The United States being the world's, still the world's sole superpower, hegemon, but that hegemon has become a vassal of the Jewish diaspora, which has been able to take control of the West through control of finance, media, academia, these choke points or strategic points, and because of their control of the narrative, no one has the capacity or the no one has the courage or the ability to scrutinize and hold these lunatics accountable.
There is this political problem, which is that the American political class should be focused on defending the American people. This is what they're sworn to try to do. Now, here, they are accepting and promoting the end of the world, basically, with the Samson option, which would be decided by a group that is not within the American democratic, apparatus, right? So this should be publicized and given scrutiny by our political class. I mean, they need to, when they read this kind of material, right, they need to say, well, we don't want you to exercise the Samson option. We want to scrutinize your whole foreign policy. If you're threatening us with extinction, we need to actually be involved in the process of you using the nuclear weapons, otherwise we can't support Israel whatsoever. And so that should just be, obvious that this should occur, but it's not. It doesn't never occurs. No one ever in our political class ever goes, we really need to take a close look at the Israeli possession and potential use of nuclear weapons because they are threatening us with it. You see, the Samson option, which is, not an official position, but is a widely understood, in the political class in Israel and is actually discussed by their intellectuals. I mean, it is a direct threat to us. Our politicians should be, kind of scrutinizing it and bringing it to, the public's attention as part of, well, what are we going to do about Israel? How do we relate to this country?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the Samson option undermines the case that Israel is our greatest ally and friend, right? That we hear so often.
Yeah, when they threatened it with you with a destruction, it sort of
mean,
begs the question, doesn't it? Yeah.
it's like at the same time, you have like Nancy Pelosi saying that, that there our commitment to Israel is ironclad and indefinite forever. And nothing can challenge it, and even if Washington were to be burned to a cinder, our support for it would not cease, and that's how committed she is to this.
Yeah, but it would cease if you're not in existence any
Well,
longer.
that's the thing, is they're destroying
So.
they're destroying the empire, and the muscle actually is the source of actual Jewish power, because it's the actual that's the physical power that they get by mentally controlling the West, the through Hasbara, as the that's the whole idea of perception management, control, propaganda, which they're so adept at. But again, these things are it's just accepted as sort of truth, the commitment to Israel. But political axioms, they're powerful things, and for the average American, they're not going to question them, because they hear them repeated. It takes I would say someone with higher intelligence or curiosity or interest to these things, or just courage, because to challenge these things is to be declared, outside the political mainstream, and you can be ostracized, and of course you can be accused of, being called of all things an anti-Semite just for even questioning it, even though you look at the facts on the ground. Skepticism is in order here, just for our own self-interest, just for an interest of fairness, our own self-interest. But again, it's Israel's our greatest ally. Even they can, no one can really identify what interest of the United States they support or promote. they say it's our only ally in the region. Well, that's not really true if you think about it. I mean, states don't really have friends; they have interests, mutual interests. That's what you look for. That's sort of realpolitik. So get to create the sort of sentimental idea that we've shared values and this stuff is ridiculous. But of course, we wouldn't have enemies in the area if we didn't have Israel as our ally, because the problem stems from the creation of Israel. I was watching this one documentary on the Israeli nuclear program, and one scientist said it, because of the Holocaust, of course, and because we are a country with very vulnerable borders surrounded by enemies. Well, this is a problem they created because you carved out a country by ethnically cleansing the area and forcing them to the periphery. So you created the very situation that you claim is your security problem. So as long as you exist, there's a security problem. This is a problem you created, yet this becomes the world's problem. This is very typical of the Jewish community. Their problems are everyone else's problems. And not to mention is that whenever there's a problem with Jews, it's the problem, it's other people's anti-Semitism. It's never anything they do. So they weave a very, self-serving, lachrymose tale of persecution, but they're never at fault for anything. A good example is Hamas. Most recently, Hamas attack, this October 7th attack, is unprovoked. What are you kidding me? I mean, I'm sorry. I guess for people whose memory only goes back to last night's CNN, broadcast, that may work. But there's a 75-year history of this. And more like a 100-year history of, the Zionist project actually being implemented after World War I. And it was a bunch of European Polish Jews coming to the country and engaging in terrorism. And that's where the cycle of violence starts in that area. It's this particular, it isn't a, you know, this isn't a 3,000-year-old conflict. It's a 100-year-old conflict. And Zionism is the source of it, because that's the conflict. And it's the ideology of Zionism which creates the problem, because it's expansionist and it doesn't give any rights to anyone else. And
Wow.
I told someone else that it's just Jewish. It's not really Jewish, it's Talmudic. And there's a distinction there.
Well, I
Don't go to
would.
the Old Testament to understand what's going on in the Middle East today. Go to the Talmud and you have a better understanding of what's going on in the Middle East and around the world today and throughout the West.
Yeah, for sure. I would say that you want to add to that an understanding of Freemasonry. Because, as I mentioned before, the political power that leads up to the Balfour Declaration is 100% Freemasonic. 1840 is really when Zionism started, and it wasn't a Jewish program. It was Grandmaster Freemasons in Britain that had the idea that now is the time for the Jews to return to the homeland. And Jewish intellectuals of the era were just stunned by this, interest in Anglicans for moving the Jews out of Europe back to the Holy Land. They thought this was, news to the Jews, was an expression, So the Freemasons had this idea, and from that moment on, from 1840, when Palmerston made the statement, and then his, I believe it's his father-in-law, Shaftesbury, made the quote that, Palestine would be it's a region without a people that can be a home for a people without a country, which then was borrowed by the Jewish Zionists in like the beginning of the 20th century. But it was originally understood as the Freemason position. The Freemasons funded all the original surveys, which was, they were doing in order to understand the region in terms of what would be needed militarily to control it. From they brought British troops into the region. They bought the Suez Canal. Rothschilds bought the Suez Canal. So, and then it was constantly promoted. Zionism was then promoted financially through the Freemasons and the British royal family. They hired people to go and to break up the idea that was very common in Europe in Reform Judaism, that the Jews could coexist with Gentiles and that Judaism could end up being a light for the world. These were kind of the Platonic ideas that were in circulation. That all had to go. And these were purportedly Gentile missionaries. Can you imagine this into the Reform Judaism communities to try to shape modern Zionism? And all of this led up to Theodor Herzl, who was also a creation of the British Freemason Zionist project. He doesn't come from nowhere. He's set up by these individuals with their philosophy. And so now, then you start in the 1880s, 1890s, then you start getting the Jewish Zionist conferences, where they're actually promoting it in a large way.
Well, that's when you have the Jewish, they come to America within a few decades, they become very influential, at least a few of them
Yeah, that's right. At
become
the
very
same time,
influential in the United States.
but
Jewish
anyway, the point is, I
financiers, yeah.
don't think this can stand any scrutiny. I think if, and I've tried to do this when I do podcasts in Israel, I try to get the Israelis to look at the origins of Zionism, and just say, what was the purpose of the Freemasons doing this? Who are the Freemasons? How is this really related to your history as a nation? You know, because remember, the Freemasons were certainly involved in the creation of Nazi Germany. How do you square that circle? You know, I mean, so these are the real, I think, kind of clear indications that we have from study of history that the whole project was artificial. It's not organic to the Jewish psychology. This is a group of people that want to insert this, and
yeah, well,
they don't care who they have to kill in order to get it done.
You know, the Freemasonic project became regnant without the West, particularly after the French Revolution. And so you have liberalism becomes the sort of the standard political ideology of the day, so to speak, with the collapse of the monarchies, or the collapse of the Christian West, but just as far back as the Reformation and these things. But just something like the British Empire, which by the mid of the 19th century had become largely a Rothschild project, who are Jewish. So you have this fusion of Freemasonic, you know, like you could say, speculative Freemasonic to practice it. It's very, very similar to Jewish rituals, by the way, which is interesting to say the least. But at the very least, the two are fused. And by the 19th century, the British Empire had become, you know, the sort of this international financial giant, largely under the Rothschilds, which then their tentacles were spread throughout Europe and into the United States. So you have that going. It's hard to distinguish, you know, British from the Rothschild Jewish interest at that point. So you can call it Freemasonic, you can call it Jewish. Neither of those characterizations are incorrect. They're both correct, in my estimation.
Yeah, there's no distinction whatsoever.
Yeah.
The Rothschild understanding of the world, the Freemason, promotion of the state of Israel and the British foreign policy are all just one thing.
And it's consistent. It's consistent with Talmudism.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course.
So there's no. So they practice. You know, okay, how does a small minority maintain its dominance? Well, it attains financial power, then political power, and this was largely obtained with Jewish emancipation in the West in the wake of the French Revolution, the Napoleonic period. You had Jewish emancipation throughout the West, so the traditional illiberal restrictions on Jewish power and access to these things were smashed, and so liberalism is sort of an empty vessel, which it can talk of highfalutin ideas of universal equality, equality, fraternity, these things, and liberty, but those are sort of empty ideas. And so if you have a group that is ruthless enough and has the identity and also the willingness to operate and infiltrate like the Jews do, that you can take over using the language of liberalism, and then when the time comes, suppress it. We're seeing today with, you know, concepts of hate.
Yeah, so well said. I mean, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So
that's the 20th century.
Exactly, that's the 20th century. So they insert multiculturalism.
Yes,
and kind of amorphous intellectual kind of understanding of, like, well, we're all going to be this, you know, ethnic clump. There won't be anything, you know, no racism. But this is just being done. You can actually mechanically see it if you look at the letters of the Zionists, the Jewish Zionists are writing to one another in the 20th century, that this is just being done to weaken the Gentiles for the political domination by the ethnic Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? I mean, it's just, if you actually go through these letters and try to make some sense out of them, you know, you can see what they're doing. It's not that complicated.
A society like Great Britain, which was, of course, founded, I would say, really on the English Reformation and the seizure of church property. That's kind of when Britain becomes the imperial dominant power, the industrial power, and through capitalism and liberalism, and that's a very, it becomes very economically dominant, but it's very vulnerable to infiltration and control. We saw that. And so and same with the United States, by the way, and which, by the way, which are operating on Freemasonic principles, the idea of the American separation of church to state, and these are all very again, they, it sounds good, it appeals to our sense of tolerance and decency, but at the same time, it denies us sort of the identity and the institutional protections against a group that can a very ruthless group that can infiltrate and take over using the very language that we say define us. A good example is the Jewish violation of the First Amendment. They have no regard for the First Amendment. They have no regard for the principles that supposedly define America, but they can use it to get control, which they have in the past century. You know, it's not easily quick. It's not like you're not going to understand this by taking a typical American civics class.
No.
You know, so
You know,
that's the, you know, that's the dilemma the West finds itself in.
so this then is now, you know, becomes real time when you look at the criticism that Jews are levying against American universities because
That's a
they're
great
students.
example. Yeah, the Jewish billionaires are pulling the plug on Ivy
Yeah,
League
the Jews, but they're
schools.
pulling the plug, and all that it's because it's in no case that these university professors are saying, well, you know, Hamas has a reasonable case, you know, to you know, do this terrorist stuff. What they are complaining about is that the statements are describing, at least to some extent, both sides of the struggle,
That's it. Yes. It, yeah.
where they will simply say that, you know, all lives matter and the violence is, in other words, because they aren't prejudicial in favor of the Jewish response and slaughter of all the Gazinians, they are anti-Semitic. This is actually what is, you know, being described by current American, you know, Jewish intellectuals. They're like Polakoff and Brettler, these guys who write for Real Clear Wire. I don't know if you saw that, but they were just saying that this is anti-Semitic and that the Americans leading in universities have this anti-Semitic problem. And it be, and they were then giving as they were given their citations that the denunciations of the Palestinians terrorist attack were not fervent enough, and they had a kind of nuance to them which just somehow pointed out that, well, you know, the Palestinians have kind of a rough go over the last 100 years. That was the basis for anti-Semitic
Yes.
accusation.
Yes. Pretty much, if you provide context or say there's two sides of the story that we have to take a nuanced approach to this, or if you're just protesting, let's say, you know, you're one of the many Palestinians or Arabs that have been, you know, imported into the country via Jewish immigration policy since 1965, and their ADL support for diversity is our strength agenda, which is non-European, non-white immigration to the country. You invite a whole lot of brown people who identify Palestinians. Then when they start to protest, well, their golems become a little,
Yeah.
you know, lose
And you know,
control.
this
That's, you know, now they want to suppress
like
free speech. Well, good examples. They'll come to America and they'll use this liberal system of Jews, whether it's in Hollywood or in industry finance. They'll employ ethnic nepotism and their Jewish business practices to amass a whole lot of wealth. And then they'll bestow that well ill-gotten wealth on universities and various institutions and think tanks in the name of philanthropy. But Jewish philanthropy, of course, comes with a lot of strings attached to it. One is control the culture, control the academic environment. So you have suppression of the university, your destruction of the university. So it's Platonic ideal where people go there to learn and debate. No, you have to. It's what determines the course of philanthropy, Jewish philanthropy, what determines what is allowed to be said on campus and the media, is it good for the Jews? That's their question. Is it good for the Jews? And show again, once again, these Jewish billionaires show their Jewish solipsism and their neuroticism and and again their inability to introspection and their again, is it good for the Jews? So all
Yeah, they're
ideas
extreme.
of academic freedom and free speech are suppressed, but here they open their checkbooks. Again, they use their immense wealth. They get control of these institutions, financial, cultural. Then they use it to suppress, to destroy the American ideal. So then we have to ask ourselves, should they be permitted this august positions in our society if they can't play by its rules? It
Yeah,
goes
like
back to that earlier question. This is
one example
this
of.
speaks to the problem of Jewish emancipation. If you have a group that doesn't practice reciprocity in your liberal society, and as a group, they don't believe in reciprocity because of the Talmud, you have a serious cultural, a serious political problem here that has to be addressed, that isn't addressed by the rules of our the accepted rules of our civic order, meaning we're supposed to believe in free speech, and also we're not supposed to identify ethnicity as being important. Although with this group, it is all important. So much so that they're gonna network, continue to network, and flex their financial power to suppress criticism of the exercise of their power. So we're
Right.
caught in a loop here. I mean, so.
Well, we are caught in the loop, and they create they create this self-correcting process in the minds of all of the academic leaders, the heads of the universities and things, where they just are automatically self-correcting against any kind of, say, European political power, right? That always has to go into the category of racism. And then, of course, they have to always promote on the other side of that. They have to self-correct, whenever there's black violence, or they have to put out the equivocation of, well, look at the problems they've had, slavery and things. But here, like at Middlebury College, their Lori Patton, she made a statement, a warning against, in terms of the Gaza situation. Hate, racism, ethnic discrimination, anti-Semitism, or Islamic phobia. This statement was seen as anti-Semitic because it equivocated anti-Semitism and Islamic phobia on an equal plane. And so what they're trying to do is but you see, the problem is, of course, they've created these self-correcting mechanisms in the mind of someone like Lori Patton. So now she can't even talk. She
No.
can't. Because she doesn't really have a way to create a declarative sentence that doesn't get attacked, because it's a, because there was just so many self-correcting
Well,
aspects
here's the thing.
to.
On a college campus, you can't misgender someone because that's hate speech. But you can advocate wiping out the entire all the Palestinian people and
Right,
use them as a
exactly. See,
fence.
exactly right. And this is really what America has come to, is that
Yes.
the self-correcting intellectual structures that have been put into us by the Judeo-Masonic, media are now basically ending the capacity of like any kind of declarative sentence. Because no matter what you do, you there on one side, if you promote BLM, then you have to worry on the other side about, well, where did the Palestinians fit into BLM, And so they are now, reason itself is just thwarted, and you get people like Patton who make statements which are really, I mean, if you think about it, she warns against hate, racism, ethnic discrimination, anti-Semitism, or Islamic phobia. Well, Laurie, I hate to say it, but I'm not sure that this is actually mechanically possible. You see what I mean? You can't be both. You have to, when you sometimes you have to draw a line and go, well, this group may be behaving a little bit poorly, and so we're going to focus on that. But when she's telling the students to not have any hatred or any racism or any ethnic discrimination, at the same time, no anti-Semitism, but don't have any
Well,
Islamophobia.
you mean to
Well,
tell me?
what are they left with as what they can think about, what they can talk about?
Well, you're going to tell me that all these years, Jews and their immense power in the West, financial, political, cultural, or the Israeli state, have never done anything to warrant criticism?
No, they never have,
It's
evidently.
anti-Semitic. I mean, that position is ridiculous. But nevertheless, anytime you criticize them, you're guilty of anti-Semitism. A good example here, we're talking about these billions. One was billionaire Ronald Lauder, who wrote a letter threatening to stop donations to the University of Pennsylvania. And, basically, it's over the Israeli-Hamas conflict, and he says he's devoted 40 years of his life to fighting anti-Semitism all over the world. That's criticism of Jews, by the way. And based now that the university, which has a whole lot of, Palestinian or people who identify as Palestinians, brown people, if we will, oppressed people, if you will, people of color, if you will, who identify more with the plight of the Palestinians or identify, they sympathize with the Palestinians more than say the pale-skinned Jews. Again, based on the rules that they create, at the very least, they should be allowed to have events and protests and engage in dialogue and some sort of Socratic method to debate the matter. But they
Yeah.
want to suppress that then. And their idea is you give money to university, then you basically got to do what I want. in the past, the money's been split on university because, and you entrust the university to do what's right with it. In a sound culture, that's what would happen. Now these universities have been sort of hijacked by radicals, largely because of Jews, by the way. But you have this conflict here. Same thing with, it was Ackerman at Harvard, another billionaire. He was pulling funding from Harvard because Harvard, again, is hosting events or students are protesting. I think it's Ackerman who wanted the names of the students that signed a letter of protest to make sure that they wouldn't be hired by any company. So he's forming a Jewish blacklist.
And then, that was really funny. And then he says,
probably, I think that's illegal. I think,
well, of course it is.
Much sue his rich ass, you know, for doing that.
It's racist. But it's actually quite funny because the idea that, well, if you don't stop this behavior, I'm going to withdraw my money. That's like saying, you know, if you don't stop, doing things I don't like, I'm going to shoot myself. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the best thing that could happen to those universities would be to have the power of the money that these people hold over them withdrawn.
Well, doesn't Harvard have like a $50 billion endowment? Doesn't Harvard have like a $50 billion endowment?
It does, yeah.
So they could tell them to take a hike. But the problem is, again, the financial power is much more than that, because this feeds into the control of the banking system, the central, who owns the Fed and these things. So the Jewish financial power is much more than these handful of these billionaires, whether it's Lauder, Leslie Wexler, or Ackerman. It's much more. This is just exposing one aspect of it.
Particularly more because they have the media, and that's more powerful than money itself, because that gets into the minds of people. And where is the counterbalance to their domination, to the domination of Israel being incapable of doing anything wrong, and that this whole process is described as a never-ending response by the Israelis to aggression from the Palestinians, right? I mean, all you have to do is just flip that 50 degrees and go, well, it's actually the other way. I mean, the aggressions were always, you know, look at the history of the process. It's always, in fact, the Zionists driving out the Palestinians and then using violence against them whenever they want. And if the Palestinians do any kind of a physical response, then they are absolutely evil, right down into the idea that we can just exterminate them and there's no moral issue.
Well, they've tried peaceful attempts like the BDS movement, right? And there's laws passed.
Sure.
Jews have gotten laws passed in various states suppressing that. That's a peaceful movement. So then you deny them peaceful opposition or peaceful protest, you're going to get violence. And then they get violence. And then the violence is then used as an excuse to further concretize Jewish identity, because Jews are never at fault for anything.
Yeah, one really interesting thing that happened was a poll was done in Israel a couple of days ago, and they found over 60% of the Israelis didn't buy the story. They felt that Netanyahu had permitted the event to occur or knew about it, you know, could have stopped it. There was something fishy about what happened. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it, right, that given their, you know, the technology they have for observation of the border, there is no chance that this, you know, bad Chuck Morris movie, you know, hang gliders attacking a music festival kind of thing could ever have occurred just in and of itself. It would have been stopped. So it was fake. So over 60% actually believe that. In Israel today, this was the result of the poll.
We'll hear about that one lady who was at the music festival. She's a Jew, Jewish lady. And she was taken prisoner by Hamas and said she was treated decently. But she claims that like over 90% of the casualties at that concert were from Jews responding, meaning heavy firepower, meaning that they were caught in a crossfire. And it was Jews firing upon the crowd, which killed most of the participants there.
Yeah, and incidentally, I would bet, if I'm not sure to what extent this can ever be undisclosed, you know, in a real sense, but the actual event, I think you're going to find out there can be a heck of a lot more Gentiles died than Jews in that event. I'd be willing to bet, just because you can look at the the rave party, how they moved it, and how they made sure that a lot of foreigners were in attendance. So I'm sure that they would have had, since they had knowledge of this about to occur, they would have had agents to control it. Not saying a lot of Jews didn't die or taken hostage, but I'll bet you that the most of the blood that was spilled
Well,
here was
powerful Jews are always willing to kill little Jews for their objectives.
always, and never,
So that's nothing new. That
never
doesn't
a
mean.
problem. So of course they wanted him, and this is a, this is a huge media spectacle that they're going to use, I would say, ultimately for the complete evaporation of the Palestinian control over Gaza. So they really want the Chuck Norris movie to be sensational and to have, and therefore they're going to put some blood into it. And yeah, that's how I understand the event. So we're sitting now on the precipice. They've assembled all of the like hundreds and hundreds of tanks and appear to be about to roll south. They're in the northern above the northern border. What do you think is going to be the response, Tim, if they come in and they just start steamrolling, the Gazans, and there's massive slaughter of
Well,
civilians? And
urban warfare is dirty and messy. These tanks aren't going to be able to maneuver rubble, and they're going to find themselves finding, clearing out tunnels. And I don't know if the IDF soldiers are, again, someone that aren't, they're willing to kill for Israel, but not die for Israel. So,
I think it's going to be an absolute bloodbath. I think that one of the things, which incidentally, the bombing of the hospital, which actually was the bombing of the parking lot next to the hospital,
yes, it was probably a
looks
JDAM
to me like
bomb, it
it
looks like.
was thermobaric, the technology that the Russians used so successfully in Ukraine, which kind of negates tunnels to some extent because they are able to create temperatures of such a degree. It gets pretty far underground, 3,000 degrees. And it certainly paralyzes the surface area. So I think and also I, as you know, my position from last week, that I think that Hamas is basically a tool of Israel. So I think that this is all orchestrated just to create a pretext for genocide. That's all it is.
Well,
Hamas is going to let them come in and maybe do another terrorist event just to give a further pretext. And then the Israelis will say, well, my gosh, we've got to roll south, and they're just going to slaughter people, push them against the border. At some point, Egypt will let them in, and now they'll be pushed out of Gaza. They'll be a for in foreign camps in Egypt, from where they'll be dispensed around the world. And then the Israelis will have, if you look at the process of how the Palestinian territory has been shrunk systematically over the last 100 years, well, this is going to end up just being another one of those events in which Palestinians are genocided, their territory is taken, and then they'll move on to the West Bank, clean that up, and you'll have the beginning of Eretz Israel.
And at the end of the day, again, why is the world so obsessed with this piece of real estate in the Middle East? The fact that they could be a spark for a nuclear war. The good thing is, it looks like Iran, Hezbollah hadn't taken ha didn't take the bait, and so a wider war may not may be avoided
I
here.
lost you too. I don't know exactly where it was. I had just finished my little piece, and then you've just got a few words, and I lost you.
Oh yeah, I just again this fact the whole world is obsessed with the who owns this piece of real estate in
That was the last thing I heard.
Middle East. Good thing is it looks like Hezbollah and Iran aren't taking the bait, and a wider conflict might be avoided. However, it's resolved in Gaza. How bad it is for the Palestinian people. The issue for the United States for the West is just what it how this crisis reveals the extent of Jewish power in the West, the ability to control the debate, which is our problem, the Jewish question. Going back to this billionaire question, these universities is that the fact the question if you're gonna if what defines America is freedom of speech and our ability to discuss these things. The Jews are not American. They don't believe in free speech. They believe in suppressing speech, calling it hate speech, speech they disagree with, then exercising their power to suppress it, to control it. So this is a question is if Jews believe that collectively, as the Jewish organizations, was the ADL or whatever, or these Jewish billionaires and the organizations they give to, if they think they can exert their financial power to suppress free speech, there's a question whether they should be permitted to have such power. as the, yeah, the, again, what they're doing with they're destroying universities just because their immediate interest, their perceived immediate interests are being threatened. So they think they have the right to destroy universities, destroy the nature of universities, an area of free debate. Obviously, these universities aren't that anymore, but it's out in the open now with this controversy. So we should, maybe consider things like barring Juice from holding any positions of power or director in any publicly traded company, restricting their financial power, restricting their culture power. They shouldn't be able to own media assets if they don't believe in these things. If they believe they can exert, these corporations just then do operate on a charter, which is a grant of privilege given to them by the U.S. government, whose charter is indeed the U.S. Constitution, which does enshrine the First Amendment. Then these companies shouldn't be able to exist, at least shouldn't be able to exist with people in charge who don't believe in the First Amendment. So ban them from owning media assets. We should ban them from making political contributions, ban them from basically, we have to, if they don't believe in the values of the greater society, they shouldn't be able to control or have influence in that greater society. That's, we're going back to a pre, French Revolution idea. But again, they've never fully embraced the Enlightenment or the liberal ideas anyway. They've only used it as a tool to get power. They don't. There's no reciprocity with these greater Jewish organizations, with the Jewish people on these matters. They believe in suppressing, because to them, anything that scrutinizes them, holds them accountable, criticizes them, is an existential threat. These people, so as a people, they can't be allowed to have that much power in our society, lest our society be destroyed, which it is now under their influence.
Yeah, I would. I'm someone who just sort of a First Amendment absolutist. I think they have every right to take that position. That what is lacking is not, kind of the suppression of them. It's the fact that there isn't any presentation of the fact that this is racial hatred and insanity. And what I would argue is that if there was just a media that was balanced against the Jewish controlled media, a media that, honestly and objectively went through what was being said and what the implications and the mind control that was coming out of that, the other media, I don't think the American public would have any trouble understanding and deflecting it at all. I just think that the mind control.
The problem is you're projecting onto them a practicality and balance and fairness, which they don't believe in. This is applied Talmudism. And
exactly.
Chutzpah, they so push it to the limit. So they're not willing to practice any reciprocity.
Of course not.
So how do you live with such people without, without ghettoizing them to some extent?
Well, you have to constantly expose. You have to constantly expose them.
Yeah.
I think if this show, our show, was as popular as like Hannity, I mean, just as a fantasy, I think that the Jewish control over media and universities, the cultural Marxism, I think it would disintegrate.
They can't even cope with YouTube channels being free.
Exactly. They can't even, because they have to censor shows that have viewerships of like a couple thousand. The idea that you took these ideas
they control Hollywood. They control all the major networks. They control all the major newspapers, and they still have to shut down people's YouTube accounts, Twitter, control Twitter, and tell Patreon to shut people down.
Yeah. I mean, banning our show from YouTube is an example of how ludicrous this and unfair it is. But the way to resolve it, I think, honestly, and also just sort of practically, because, getting them shut down, I think, would be a very hard process without.
Well, what's the traditional way to deal with the problem? 109 times.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, of course, that's always, that is kind of a natural response. I think, I think that what would happen is if you could get these ideas just publicly debated, if you got the ideas honestly represented into the public, what would crack? What would crack is the ethnocentrism and racial hatred inside like secular Jews,
Well,
first
this
of
you
all.
could if you know, the ADL have commas are is it Google and
Yeah.
YouTube and
See, the ADL would
Twitter?
just not be able to function in an environment where there was honest debate. It would just collapse because it would just be ridiculous. It would be so obvious that they are self-centered, that they are racist. You see, I mean, they promoted this idea of racism as evil, right? Even though to some extent it's just natural ethnic pride
Yeah,
and
in group preference, and yeah.
But the thing is, racism is so hypersensitive now inside our culture. If you brought out how racist their position is, I mean, just like the Samson option, you know, getting these people to actually have someone on the other side will saying, well, can you explain this from the perspective of racism, please? I mean, it would fall apart. I just think that they have their bamboozlement is really at the point of just diminishing returns. If what is needed now is exposure, what's needed now is just say, look, guys, let's have a public debate. Let's like the people who are accusing the university professors heads of as anti-Semitism because they put out a statement which is balanced in terms of the Middle East, right? In terms of the whole situation and vis-a-vis Palestinian and the Israelis. I mean, let's get that discussion in public. Where you have kind of well-informed and clear-minded people on the other side explaining the Palestinian position, explaining the position of, well, we need an honest representation of what's going on in this area, because otherwise, how can we make
Well,
it clear?
Palmer, show me a Jewish public official in Europe or the United States, a Jew that's been trusted with official power who doesn't identify first as a Jew. And that
You
might
know,
work.
honestly, God, you know, that's a good question, Tim.
I can't find one.
I can't think of one.
Blinken goes to the Middle East, supposedly to deal with this crisis. And the first thing he says is, I'm an American. I'm also a Jew. But you're dealing with a conflict between Jews. So the idea of an honest broker, well, that's out the window. Then you have Merrick Garland. He's questioned on the abuse of his power, and he starts talking about the fact that he has relatives who died or almost died in the Holocaust,
Right, I know.
and he comes out and he says, how dare you question my integrity, or how dare you accuse me of abusing my power? I can't abuse my power because I'm Jewish, because Jews don't abuse their power. It's like, what? That's basically what he said, when he's being cross-examined, being questioned on Capitol Hill. Then you have Janet Yellen, our esteemed Secretary of the Treasury, saying that we can't afford two wars, or we can afford two, yet we're because we have to do it. So of course, if you look at inflation and the spiraling debt, that's how we afford the war, is spiraling debt and inflation. So we can't afford it because our currency is being constantly debased to pay for these wars. But she's Jewish too. So again, it's like, and all that matters, what the primary objective is, the primary concern of these people is their Jewish identity, whether it's Janet Yellen, Anthony Blinken, Merrick Garland, the 450 Jews who work at the White House right now. In fact, they're so concerned about it, they had the White House convene a conference last May to develop a national strategy to combat anti-Semitism. When, if anything, what this suggests is the problem, at least within our governing bodies and our higher institutions of learning, isn't anti-Semitism, it's philo-Semitism, as you can
Yeah, we
see.
have a there's a propaganda commercial that's going around in California now, and it shows a Jewish people coming out of this little middle class home, and on the garage door there's a swastika, and it says, "No Jews, Jews go home," and the woman doesn't let her child see it, and she gets in the car and drives off, and the neighbor then has a bucket of paint, and he paints over it, so when they come back after school, they have a clean garage door, and the woman smiles at the neighbor. And then, you have this, agitprop for, like, anyway. And then it says the concluding fact it gives is that one out of four Jews experienced hate last year. And I thought to myself, I go, boy, that's not very impressive. 99.9% of Gentiles experienced hate last year. You know, I mean,
Because in case
what's
they
that?
turn, because they turn on the television.
Right. We try to tell, what about affirmative action? I mean, that's
What
kind of
about
hate.
all the protests, the Black Lives Matter, all the CRT and all that stuff? I mean, it's like.
We don't see it's like again it's like you think of they talk about the greatest catastrophe and of course as we've discussed several times the numbers that they give regarding the Holocaust are not supportable, but they talk about the 6 million. Well, you got 12 million in the Holodomor, but that's never mentioned somehow.
No.
I mean, like their deaths are they are relating to justifying the Samson option. Whereas Gentiles, we're just not even on the radar. We're racist, second class. Well, not second class. We're not even human. It's Talmudic, And so that's just the world if you look at it through the media they created.
And the reality is that in most instances, that swastika that's painted on the garage door would have been painted on by themselves just to get the attention so they can report to the
Sure.
ADL that
Very
it was
often,
an incident.
There just isn't the kind of organized or even disorganized anti-Semitism
Well,
in
apparently
the United
if you're critical of Jews, you're a Nazi, like you're the cartoon Nazi.
Yeah. Well, it's like the statement. It's
Well,
the statement by the Middlebury College president, which is just the most carefully parsed, kind of
yeah.
multicultural statement. It's like she's afraid to say anything,
Yeah.
and yet that is
That's
anti-Semitism. That,
anti-Semitic. Yeah.
right. So the thing is, they can just define it any way they want, and they
Well,
lose over.
Hamas, Netanyahu says Hamas are Nazis. They're worse than Nazis. It's like, really?
Yeah, well, they had the Bennett, the prime minister, former prime minister. He was questioned. We mentioned last week. He was questioned about, well, you cut off the electricity, and you're going to kill all of these, babies, Palestinian babies, in incubators. Is there a concern about that? He goes, what? You're worried about the Palestinians at this point? What's wrong with you? That was really an amazing statement. What's wrong with you for being concerned about the death of babies? And then he says, we're fighting Nazis. So you can see that his statement was propaganda. It's not, I don't believe that someone like that is that stupid or that hate obsessed. I think it's just organized propaganda. I think it's.
Oh, it's very not subtle, not so subtle. I saw, I think there was a blurb or a picture or an image from a news report that he was on CNN or MSNBC or something, one of the mainstream ones. And it's reporting the I guess the casualties of the conflict, and it reported Israelis as being killed, and Palestinians as just being dead. So you have the passive for the Palestinians being killed, of course, isn't passive. It's there's culpability there. So even that, Jews are killed, Palestinians just end up dead. See the
Yeah.
difference?
So of course, and I'm telling you, there's going to be a lot of passing away and evaporating of Palestinians over the next 6 months. I think that if you look at this attack of how well planned it was and the resources put into it and the extraordinary media control of like. The Israelis are being attacked. We have to, they sent two fleets. I mean, it's just preposterous, right? They've got two U.S. naval fleets off of the Gaza. And what are they? I mean, this is just inappropriate and in the most in the extreme way. They even have it in the first day. I remember they were saying, well, the Palestinians are trying to cut Israel in two. They're trying to invade through the mainland of Israel and hook up with the West Bank. I mean, these were the ideas that were being circulated in order to create the idea that Israel was at war. At war. This was a existential threat. The Palestinians represented a nation that was attacking Israel, and therefore, everything was on the table, including the sanction option. I mean, this is all preposterous, right? Just preposterous. At the very worst case, it's just a stupid terrorist attack of a few, couple hundred people that blew up some individuals at a rave concert. It doesn't represent any threat whatsoever to Israel. So the response by the media that this is actually existential threat war was, I think, obviously pre-planned. So because of all that, I'm just pointing out that this looks grim to me for the Palestinians
Well, in
because
the
it's so
meantime, what about the U.S. border?
well, it's wide open.
Yes, and so you have that's being ignored,
Yeah, and
right?
think of all the violence that occurs in our nation
Yeah.
because of the lack of border security there. But somehow we just never get to matter. We never are something that is needs to be taken into consideration by the media. Is it? Isn't it strange, you know, that you know, all of the and again, it's sort of like how the Palestinian-Israeli cycle of violence is represented. The Palestinians are always attacking. They're never reacting to, you know, all of the, you know, phosphorus bombing of civilians. They're always attacking, and the Israelis are always simply defending themselves.
Yeah, the white phosphorus bombs, which is
Yeah, so
these, yeah.
it's just ridiculous. And you know, let's hope that in this instance, because they now have an independent media that has a voice, that we can you know, try to use the circumstance to create more clarity. You know, the media is just a propaganda device, and you can't get information from it.
Well,
You've
they're
got to
actually
go.
trying to convince people that that hospital bombing wasn't the Israelis.
Sure.
And well,
It's
prove it. It's like, well, they've, I think, haven't they blown up like 50 other hospitals the past few years? At least attacked them. They've,
well,
there's
there's
a,
like
that they bragged about
seven
it. They said
other.
they were going to do
Seven
it. They
other.
bragged about it. Then they denied doing it. I'm like, what? It's
Yeah.
not,
So it's just, this is,
it's
you
part of their
know.
doctrine anyways, bombing civilians. I was like, why
Yeah.
deny it now? It's like, you know, it's
But
like,
particularly since the goal here is to drive the Palestinians south. I mean,
yes.
I would say that the goal here is to drive them south, compress them against the border, and then have some kind of dramatic peace overture by the Egyptians negotiated with, you know, Anthony Blinken to let these, you know, refugees in into Egypt. They'll have a camp for them there. And then for there, they just, you know, dispense them throughout the world. And
Well, yeah,
by my
they'll
God.
end up in Minnesota or Tennessee eventually. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is, and but to get there,
And
you're going to have.
then their children will end up in university protesting some future atrocity committed by the Israeli government, and Jewish billionaires will get mad because the university is tolerating these
Yeah,
students.
anti-Semitism. So it's just really, it's a,
By the way, who
it's
get into the university because of quotas that discriminate against whites. Who are again supported by Jews, of course, because what it does is, this was exposed last year, earlier this year, about the whole thing with Harvard and the lawsuits, is that what it does is it the quota system discriminates greatly against whites, white America, ethnic white Americans, to the benefit of brown and black students, and also particularly Asians, the primary beneficiary of these things is Jews, of course, where they're represented like over by like 1,000%, even when you account for test scores at these universities. So it's a way to get rid of a group, a cohort that, with which Jews consider competitive, and they support people. They support in bringing in people who aren't, who don't qualify, because they, at the end of the day, they don't really compete with them for political power. So it's a
Yeah,
very
when you look
cynical
at the
manipulation.
hiring, we look at the hiring stats for the last
Yes.
year of only 6% were people of European heritage. You know, the 94% were
Yeah.
others. I mean, you can see that the country, America, is now just a, it's been structured as a genocidal machine for Europeans.
But
I
then
mean,
white Republicans are obsessing over Israel.
right.
Think about that, when their country is being destroyed
Right,
by the very
when you
power that
have,
Israel
right,
represents. Yeah.
when you are being genocided in your own nation, and you're losing all financial power, you're losing, of course, your political power, when the media is dominated by another group that hates you, and you are, and your border is wide open, right, and to bring in the third world to dilute, you know, even further, you know, whatever political power your ethnicity and your interests might have. And yet, you're all you can think about is the, you know, this issue you know, inside the country in the Middle East. When you read the statements that came out the day of the event, like from the Rhino Republicans, people like Pence and the New Jersey guy, gosh darn
Christie.
it, yeah, Christie, the fat guy, they were metaphysical. I mean, they were talking about our beloved and cherished ally. I mean, it was, well, you saw that the
Yeah.
one guy was crying on TV, you know. I mean, it was just this is stupid propaganda. It's not even, they're so far past the point where it's an appropriate response to the situation that I just don't even know where it can go from here. I mean, it can't get any worse. I honestly hope it's at this, that the propaganda now will start to be reacted against, you know, because it's so ham-handed, it's so stupid that maybe now, you know, Gentiles in general will start to scratch their head and go, well, wait a second. You know, is this really an appropriate response? I mean, am I being manipulated here?
Yeah. Well, again, the crisis may stem with the fact that Ehud Barak commented that no Jewish empire has lasted longer than 80 years in history, and they're coming up on 80 years now. So that could be reflect sort of the domestic instability Israel is experiencing.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I saw the statement, and I thought to myself, you know, it's interesting that they're clearing out the Ukraine, the old Khazarian empire. Because if you look, remember, Molininsky put in the gigantic Jewish center in the shape of a menorah.
The largest synagogue is in Ukraine, from what I understand.
Yeah, right. It's the largest structure in the country. And you know, you think, well, maybe, you know, this is really, you know, kind of interesting. If you get a hot war in Israel, then maybe, you know, it's time to go back. Who knows? But it is the 80-year cycle. It's an interesting, you know, kind of data point. I don't know how realistic it is, but certainly it's easy to imagine with BlackRock and the oligarchs controlling whatever's left of the Ukraine when the depopulation of the Ukrainians is finished, that it is going to be a completely Jewish-run zone. I mean, that's kind of, I almost think, baked in the cake at this point, don't you? I mean, it's like, what would actually
that only works if Russia's defeated, and I don't think that's on the table anymore.
I don't think Russia's gonna be defeated. I think what'll happen is they'll eventually partition. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of, to me, that seems natural. There's no way the Ukrainians can do anything other than, in terms of warfare, other than just sacrifice their bodies. And at some point there will be so few of them left to sacrifice that Russia will partition. They're saying we need this as a, you know, kind of a zone and a demilitarized neutral zone. The rest of it, maybe from the, you know, to the west of Kiev, that'll be a protectorate. It won't be a real nation. And I think in that zone, you'll have BlackRock and Molininsky, you know, taking control of it very closely. And it'll just be an economic zone that'll be run by Jews. And then eventually it'll just be inhabited by them.
Well, that speaks to the problem with BlackRock, you know, Larry Fink and these corporations, Lauder, Ackerman, these corporate, you know, they represent corporate interests that are ultimately Jewish. And so this is a problem that's, again, we talked about, is you have these billionaires that are operating in various countries, whether in Europe, the United States, see themselves as part of the Jewish diaspora, and they identify with Israel, yet they operate within these various countries and use their immense wealth that they've been able to accumulate within these societies to get those countries to back their narrow interest at the expense of the host society. So we're confronted with that question again.
Yeah. The Chinese, you know, spokesperson, but it was one of the spokespeople, it made a speech, and he said, you know, the response by the Israelis is inappropriate. And he pointed out that they are no longer a diasporan country. It is the Palestinians that have that moral high ground. Mm-hmm. And isn't it bizarre that the Israelis can't give a little mercy toward a people experiencing what they claim is their sort of historical high ground to, you know, a moral advantage? You know, I thought, well, he's got a point, you know. Because
they can't guilt the Chinese. You can guilt whites. Jews successfully have guilted the whites because of their mind control efforts the past century with media and the narrative here, Holocaust narrative and civil rights, and they pathologized ethnic white identity, marginalized Christianity. Chinese civilization is a different thing. It's much older, and for better or for worse, you know, the Chinese Communist Party represents Chinese ethnicity, and they're not going to be guilt tripped into this stuff. That's the problem they faced with the Jews faced when they marginalized the Occidental identity, European, which has successfully been compromised through guilt and these things. These other cultures, non-Western cultures, can't be guilted because they don't even acknowledge the concept of guilt anyway in these things. It's like it's just pure power politics to them. And that could be nonsense.
You know, it's like when you had the COVID lockdowns and the vaccine mandates, I thought that the independent media made a lot of progress. These were like, in terms of the, power of the independent media, they were like the greatest thing since 9/11, because they were so ham-handed and so, dangerous, that it really, a lot of people stopped believing in, the mainstream media propaganda, and started to drift into, in one way or another, into sort of like listening to independent media sources. And I'm wondering if this whole situation in Gaza, which I think is going to last for a while, if it won't be another episode of that, where the explanations that the media is giving for Israel's behavior and for the slaughter of the Palestinians will just strike a lot of people who, and I think in general, the public is, or a fraction of the public is, much more sensitive now to propaganda.
Yeah,
I
the political class is well behind the curve on this, because they're bribed and blackmailed, so they're
No,
bought
true.
and paid for it. So what
Well,
they say is gonna be different than what the
yeah.
public thinks. The only
I
problem is the
just
public has no
wonder.
effective representation anymore, though.
Yeah, I wonder if the public, in terms, all I care about, honestly, is just the growth of the independent media. I think everything else is irrelevant at this point. And I think that the situation in Gaza, as tragic as it is, it might actually accelerate that, a good process, because more and more people will look at this and go, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense. I think there's already now exposure, obviously, from Israeli sources on the whole false flag nature of the terrorist event, right? I mean, this is, in the media now. And so hopefully another fraction of people will start to come over. They'll start realizing that mainstream media is just, a controlled propaganda entity, and then forget it. You don't need any of that stuff. And as the independent media gets larger, it starts to swallow, the mainstream media. In other words, like now, I think even for daily news information, more and more people are just turning away from legacy media and going into into the internet. A lot, of course, that is controlled, but nevertheless, I think here there is an opportunity for growth of honest media, where ideas are actually discussed, and they, as I've pointed out many times, they can't stand any kind of discussion. So if the independent media grows, it will bring the discussion to the public, and then that will give us a chance to have some, a political reaction against our enslavement.
Well, at the very least, it increases understanding or consciousness in the part of the public about these matters. A sophistication that perhaps wasn't there, and this is important, because if we have two carrier groups there, they're sitting ducks for perhaps a false flag event, which could spark a wider conflict. These draw the U.S. in, and so if there's a conscious understanding of these things, and maybe understanding or a knowledge of, say, like the Liberty Incident, USS Liberty Incident, 1967. That a good portion of the public will look at it as USS Liberty Attack 2.0, and they won't be able to use that. And God forbid, if that were to occur, won't be as a pretext for U.S. involvement in a wider conflict. So that
Yeah,
was.
that's right. It's going to be interesting to see what kind of technology the Gazians actually have against, like, the tank assault, right? If you get
Yeah.
300 tanks rolling down,
That's if
because
they go in. That's if they go in.
if they go in,
They might
yeah,
go
of
in.
course, yeah, they may not need to. They may be able to get their kind of maneuver accomplished without a direct invasion. They may have Egypt open the borders, and they've trashed Gaza so much that they get, like, say the whole purpose here is just to get rid of a third of the Palestinians in Gaza. Like,
Yes.
that's the goal. If that's the goal, they may reach a point and they go, okay, from here on out, we go peaceful. We try to create the idea that we're reasonable, and that we're the, damaged ones. But even so, like, we're gonna try to help everything out. And our conclusion is gonna be, we're gonna move a third of the Palestinians out of Gaza, set up a kind of control over the upper third of it, that's will now become part
No,
of Israel.
they'll clear it out and invite settlers in, and then create a
Yeah,
pretext for
and
more
then over
conflict.
time, and then the settlers will come in, and there you go, and
The beat goes on, as they say.
that may be just what they think is the best
Yeah,
outcome.
and they'll make Gaza bloom.
Like in the Bible.
Okay, Joe.
All right, Tim. Well, thanks for the discussion, and we'll get them next week, buddy. Have
Take care. Bye bye.
a great week. Bye-bye.